This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm an author, podcast host, and parent who built a long career in media. I grew up in a state of perpetual curiosity, investigating the world and asking a lot of questions. In this show, I chat with culture-defining leaders, thinkers, and experts about this rare moment that we find ourselves in and how to think about our own lives and experiences within a larger social and spiritual construct. Today, I sit down with Heather McGee, a designer of and advocate for solutions to inequality in America. We discuss her recent phenomenal book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, in which she seeks to push us all past zero-sum thinking, or the idea that if you get something you want or need, it must mean that I get less. In fact, she points to numerous examples throughout history that show how this framework has made our society crueler and poorer than it otherwise might be, for all of us. Heather pushes us to recognize the fingerprints of racism in all of our core dysfunctions, from climate change to the roots of the financial crisis to the ongoing fight for universal healthcare.
I want us to stop this kind of siloed thinking where it's like it's great for white people and bad for people of color.
Heather says,
if you pull that thread, you realize that that's the same zero-sum logic that racists hold, right? That progress for people of color has to come at white folks' expense, that we are at odds, we are fighting over crumbs. And I just felt like there's gotta be a better paradigm of mutual benefit.
The Sum of Us is a story of why drained pool politics, an idea named after the fact that in the 50s and 60s, many towns chose to fill in their public pools and lose access to the social good rather than integrate them and share them with Black people, is costing everyone in ongoing ways. She offers that with multiracial coalitions, we can subvert fear-mongering about an equitable society and fight for a more prosperous nation for all. Thank you for joining me, and congratulations. I can only imagine how many years you spent writing this book and researching this book. It is so well-crafted, so beautiful, and I know, obviously, it's a huge seller, so congrats.
Thank you. It definitely was a labor of love. Probably 3 years start to finish, but, you know, kind of probably 20 years of wrestling and puzzling and struggling.
Your book is an incredible accomplishment and so clarifying. I feel like recently there have been just like a legion of books that have really recontextualized the way that we understand race. And your book obviously is one of them. It feels like almost the perfect counterpoint to Cast or in, you know, Ibram's book, just in the context of giving us a greater understanding of like why we are here. And the central thesis around this idea of zero sum thinking and that paradigm feels so widely applicable to so many parts of our society in a way that you really deftly explore. So what was that moment for you? I know that there were many in your work where you were like, oh, you had a light bulb come on, but at what point were you like able to synthesize around that as a thesis?
You know, I had always felt a little bit uncomfortable with the way that people in my field, so I spent nearly 20 years in the economic policy world, being a researcher and an advocate around problems in the American economy, what was going on, why inequality was growing, why economic insecurity was growing, why wages were stagnant and declining while productivity was still increasing, just sort of like what gives, you know, why is it so hard for so many families to get ahead. And there were a lot of parts of the kind of typical progressive economic story that just didn't add up to me. And one of the things that I often really like bristled at was the way in which we would talk about race. This is, you know, still a pretty white male dominant field, economists, think tanks, etc. And we would often just sort of talk about people of color as this like pitied afterthought, like, you know, wages are stagnant and they're declining for Black and Brown workers, you know, like student debt is climbing and it's worse for Black and Brown workers. You know, it was just sort of like, and it just didn't feel like it had any context. And it also felt like it created this weird kind of division between what was going on with different parts of the American society without explaining why at all. And there was sort of no context or nothing that gave us a sense that we're interconnected. And I remember I was riding on the subway and I was thinking at the time about the financial crisis, which is the issue that I worked on for the first half of my career, the subprime lending that led to it, and then the aftermath, and trying to put rules on Wall Street in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And I was just thinking about how racist so much of the logic and the practices were that fueled the subprime crisis, and how many racist tropes were being used to try to undermine regulation even after the crash. And I said, you know what? Racism is a cost to white people too. And like that sentence came to me kind of like in total. And I was like, that's right. That's right. Like, I want to explore more of that. I want us to stop this kind of siloed thinking where it's like, it's great for white people and bad for people of color. And therefore, you know, we're completely separate and at odds. And if you pull that thread, you realize that that's the same zero-sum logic that racists hold, right? That progress for people of color has to come at white folks' expense. That, you know, we are at odds. We are fighting over, you know, crumbs. And I just felt like there's got to be a better paradigm of mutual benefit. There's got to be a better paradigm that is more realistic about the ways in which you can only exploit one part of our society for so long. There's just got to be a better way, and there's got to be a truer story here.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, and this idea of when there's oppression, society, class, race, gender, how more common it is to see sort of horizontal oppression rather than actually like fighting or addressing the system and that creates the inequity, and how easy it is to turn people against each other who should be united against a more common enemy, even if that enemy might be sort of the invisible structure. And I thought that this, the way that you also start the book with this beautiful metaphor of the public pools that, you know, disappeared across the country in the North and in the South with desegregation, but this idea too that it was so entrenched that white people would rather not have the public goods than share the public goods, mm-hmm. which is also just so wild. You know, your description of that, the pool in St. Louis, Missouri that could accommodate, was it like 10,000 people, mm-hmm. that would be disappeared rather than integrated is so wild. Like and I know the book is an exploration of that, but like, how does that start? Like, where does that fear come from?
I tell the story of the drained public pools, not because I'm a big swimming aficionado, although I do love to swim, but it's because it's really a metaphor for what happened to the entire kind of New Deal public goods commitment. Social Security, massive investment in housing, strong collective bargaining and labor laws, antitrust rules that made it easier for small businesses to compete, just sort of a responsive government that invested massively in infrastructure and research and development that kept college affordable by having government pick up the tab. All of those public goods helped to create the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. And you know, to be honest, when Trump talks about make America great again, the kind of better part, the less nefarious and evil part of that nostalgia that he was sort of plucking as a note in our collective consciousness was the desire to get back to that, a time when we were putting a man on the moon, not like a billionaire into upper space, but like a man on the moon, you know, and a time when one guy could like walk into a factory and come out set for life, and where, you know, there was just this sort of strong middle class security. But as I talk about in the book, all the public goods that created that were for whites only, either explicitly, as in the massive investments in housing and home ownership, which the federal government explicitly required private developers and private banks to exclude Black people from the housing developments and from the entire mortgage market out of some never substantiated idea that Black people were risky, and or things that were less explicit, like the GI Bill, which was this, you know, huge benefit that helped shore up the middle class and expand it after World War II. But because those public benefits were filtered through racially exclusionary higher education and housing sectors, Black GIs who were coming home were often discriminated against and weren't eligible. And so that whole sort of public goods ethos, but only for a public that is perceived to be good, really was tested by the civil rights movement and was tested by, you know, in very concrete ways, literally Black families showing up at the pool and saying, hey, you know, these are our tax dollars. We want our kids to swim too. And, you know, the result was in so many places across the country, these drained public pools and a retreat from the public and a shift towards the private sector as the solution for everything, and the sort of rise of this sort of like market fundamentalism and a sort of unwillingness of the majority of white Americans to support the vision and the formula that had created in large part their economic security, right? The stat that just blew my mind was, it's from this big survey data called the ANES. It's not that important, but in 1956 and 1960, 2/3 of white Americans believed that government ought to guarantee a job to anyone who wanted one, who couldn't find one in the private sector, and guarantee a minimum level of income that no one should fall below. I mean, that's like wild in today's politics, right? Those are like radical socialist ideas, a job guarantee and an income guarantee. Nearly 70% of white folks, and between 1960 and 1964, support among white people fell in half for that, those two ideas. And so I looked at that and I was like, you don't have that. Like, it was the next time that this every 4-year survey was fielded. So like, you don't have that kind of a dramatic decline without something exogenous happening, right? Something happening in the world that radically shifted people's public opinion. And I thought about, okay, so what happened between 1960 and 1964, right? We had the March on Washington, 1963, which was for jobs and freedom, and which included a job guarantee and a national living wage as part of demands, like the very small number of demands that the Black activists mostly, you know, were bringing to the mall. And then we had 1963 was the year that President Kennedy went on this media blitz around civil rights, sort of bringing into Americans' homes this idea that the party of the New Deal was going to also be the party of civil rights. And then, of course, we know that his successor, Lyndon Johnson, would become, after signing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, and sort of, you know, being the civil rights president, he would become the last Democrat running for president to win the majority of the white vote.
Hosting this podcast is a great privilege. I'm so grateful to all of you for listening and to the amazing teachers and thinkers and experts who join me every week. There's nothing better than going deep with someone who has spent a good amount of their life thinking about the issue in question. It's like going back to school. So what's another place to learn from some of the most remarkable experts alive today? Masterclass. There are over 180 masterclass instructors, including experts in leadership, negotiation, writing, and cooking. You can learn from former FBI agent Chris Voss, who teaches negotiation, Carla Welch, who teaches personal style, Bobby Brown, who teaches us how to put on makeup, which is a new fascination for me, or Esther Perel, who teaches relational intelligence. Don't miss Esther's recent episode on Pulling the Thread. These instructors become your own personal mentors, helping you gain real-life skills.
I use MasterClass and you should too. There are more than 200 classes to pick from with new ones added every month. For example, my good friend and former Pulling the Thread guest, Emily Morse, is on there teaching about sex and communication. And if there's anyone you want to invite into the bedroom with you and your partner, it should be her. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/thread. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/thread. masterclass.com/thread. Throughout, there are these other statistics to support the fact that even now, I mean, the fact that a majority, is it a majority or it's close to a majority of Republicans want universal health care. Like the policies of people in parties are typically far more progressive, or the policies that they desire are far more progressive than how we're being represented in Washington. Mm-hmm. And yet it's the same. I want to talk about, I mean, there are so many flags, you know, subprime mortgages and healthcare and all of these things. But first, let's talk a little bit about, you talk about how sort of the old-fashioned biological racism, how that's waned, right? So the statistic you give is in 1972, 31% of white people subscribed to biological racism. By 1986, just 14%, but still high. I would hope it's lower, but it's unclear. But then you talk about sort of this transition away from overt racism to racial resentment and the dog whistling that was happening from Reagan, from others, implying that, of course, you know, Black people are struggling because they are takers, not givers. You know, all of these sort of binaries, these racial stereotypes that have been seeded and flogged as some sort of universal truth. Where did that, was it Reagan who really sort of driving those stakes in, or how did that start?
Yeah, I mean, so in the book, I try to kind of denaturalize all of these things, right? I try to think, okay, well, the zero-sum way of looking at the world, it's not natural, right? It's not like human nature. Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, white folks tend to see the world more through this zero-sum prism than do people of color. So it's obviously a story, as I say in the book, you know, everything we believe comes from a story we've been told. So I want to know who's telling the story to white folks, and why are they buying it? Who's selling it for their own profit? Like, why is it profitable to them? And it turns out that the story is really old, right? It's really an old way of seeing the world that was created in order to justify the economic system in the colonial era, right? That was created by the colonial plantation elite to sell basically European indentured people, bonds people, servants, on the idea that they were better than indigenous and Black servants, that they were often, you know, working side by side with. And it was really accelerated this sort of zero-sum worldview in the wake of a whole bunch of cross-racial servant uprisings that threatened to overthrow the colonial plantation elite. And they were like, whoa, wait a second. We can't have all of the people who are not rich, you know, taking up arms against us. We need the white-skinned people, our fellow European sort of Christians, to be on our side, even though we're exploiting them. And so that basic story is what you see time and time again and again. And it's sort of reanimated every generation. You know, racism is this old wound, but there's always, you know, basically a narrow self-interested elite that's willing to profit by salting that wound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the most obvious current example is the way that the right wing has really taken this racial resentment story and made it their core narrative. But in the modern era, it definitely came, you know, first from Nixon with the law and order politics, the sort of, you know, this, all of this social upheaval during the Vietnam War era and civil rights and women's rights. That's terrifying to this sort of white, forgotten, silent majority. And so let's basically realign white voters to see progress as threatening to them and put a racial cast on it. But it was really, you're right, Ronald Reagan who sort of married the racist dog whistles with anti-government politics, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not a given that someone, some white person who doesn't like their black and brown neighbors who sort of believes racist stereotypes about them also doesn't want free healthcare. You know what I mean? Like it's not actually yeah. a given. Like that has to be worked at to firmly associate government with race. And that's what really happened. I mean, it first happened by, as I talk about in The Drained Pool, it first happened by basically saying that the public is gonna include all of the public and the beneficiaries of America's prosperity are gonna include all the people who contribute to it, right? Like that sort of core idea that the government went from the enforcer of the racial hierarchy to the upender of the racial hierarchy with civil rights and integration and school desegregation, that happened all very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And frankly, a lot of the people in Washington today were, you know, kids and teenagers when that happened. And it was a betrayal of the stories that powerful people and government and business had told white Americans about their sort of place in the world. And I don't know that just like on a deeper level, I think that was sort of a wound. It was like, you told me I was the best and I was on top and I was naturally good and that there was something wrong with these other people. And now you're gonna tell me that I have to be equal to them. And mm-hmm. I don't trust you then. And the you was the public, was the government, was policy, was politics. And so I think that's really like the core underlying logic that Reagan was able to exploit. You know, government is what we do together and the together, the we, you know, if it's a multiracial we, if the we and we the people is really all of us, that's scary to people who really do believe there's something wrong with people of color. Or mm-hmm. as you say, or most people of color, right? So like, you know, today's biological racism, as you noted, that's not usually the flavor. It's more like, it's not black people, it's thugs. It's not brown mm-hmm. people, it's illegals, right? So it's a moral judgment on a subsection of a culture that nonetheless sort of stands in for the whole culture. And mm-hmm. so it's like, we don't wanna, as I you know heard very often, for example, I traveled to Mississippi and talked to workers who had just been working to organize their auto factory, a Nissan car factory. And a lot of the rhetoric among the people who voted no was, well, the union is for Black people because Black people are lazy. Mm. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, well, actually Black people are most likely because of a lot of job discrimination at the plant, the management's almost universally white. The Black folks are more likely to be the ones on the assembly line who are actually working like at the pace of the robots. So there's actually, you know, and as one of the sort of older Black workers told me, he said, you know, the kinds of jobs that you're more likely to get if you're white are so cush, he called them. He said, they're so cush that you can go straight from the plant to the happy hour. You don't have to go home and shower, right? So that's that inverse. Yeah. Like actually, you know, who's working really back-breaking, dirty, hard jobs? It's the people whom are supposed to be, you know, thinking are lazy.
I mean, I think you mentioned sort of the wounds of racism, the intergenerational trauma that probably majority of people in America feel in some way. Like historically everyone sort of been brutalized in time and terrible ways, and then, you know, traumatize people. But I think the other, you know, which you touch on, but there's this also this undercurrent, particularly in the context of class in this country and the way that the middle class has been decimated, the working class is being exploited, and how racism shows up in terms of policing, all of the things. There's this woman, a prison abolitionist, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and she talks about sort of this idea of racism as also being sort of people who feel very proximal to death. Like you are just barely surviving. You could be killed. And I feel like that is America. You know, we have no social system, the social support, except obviously there's welfare for corporations, and we have no problem giving companies massive tax break, essentially giving them social services. We have such an upside down system, but we have no social net. I mean, when you talk about sort of welfare and that, or sorry, Medicaid and that fight, the federal desire to broaden Medicaid to ensure massive amounts of people, and then people like Rick Perry in Texas being like, I don't want your money, and keeping that bar set up. What is it, $3,600 or something in order to qualify? Like, there is something so sadistic about the way that we keep Americans on the precipice of death, or one fatal decision or one missed payment resulting in devastation in a way that is so visceral. I mean, I feel it as like a relatively affluent white woman, where I'm like, am I gonna, you know, is my whole life gonna fall apart?
No. There's no security because there's no valuing of our lives and our humanity. And I really do, I just think there's no way that that's not traced back from the original ways in which we were so callous about life in this society. You know, we were founded on genocide, kidnapping, torture, forced labor, rape, like that's our founding, right? And so that's what created the original wealth in this country. That's what we were able to tolerate in the name of profit. And it's what we were able to ignore while we extolled freedom and equality and liberty, right? So core contradiction, you know, we're so young, right? I mean, it's really, it's still with us in many ways. And I think the disciplining force, that kind of like the flames lapping at the heels, right? The sort of like, there's this hierarchy of human value, this ladder, where it's like, you know, you can be at the very top and afford your own space rocket. But if you're at the bottom, you know, if you're at the bottom, and you may even work at the same company, right? But if you're at the bottom of that ladder, you are one busted brakes away from losing your home and losing custody of your kids, right? As sort of like a snowball of what could happen there. And I think because of that, that scarcity and that cruelty, which I think we wouldn't have without systemic racism and without the racist logic of dehumanization, paradoxically then feeds zero-sum thinking and resource hoarding and desire to not see your neighbor get his fingers on your rung of the ladder, this thing called last place aversion and group status threat, this idea that for other people to come up, you've got to go down. And it's simply not true economically, and I talk about that throughout the book, that even things like reparations, which I think are often thought of in very zero-sum ways, and there's a lot of like purse clutching, like, oh my God, like what will happen if we really pay the debt that this country owes to Black people? And it's like, it's not coming out of your pocket, you know, any more than any like 15 is. Like, we're not, you know, it's not like the government's gonna knock on every door and ask people to write a check to the nearest Black neighbor. Like, that's not the way it works. Like, it is about a collective debt that is owed by the same government that enforced and wrote all of these laws to strip and deny wealth from people of color in an intergenerational way. And righting that wrong is about investing seed capital in the nation we're becoming, because you know, we've really got to recognize that we all need to have more economic security. And if you look at the kinds of policies that Black Americans tend to support more, right? We are the biggest voting bloc, right? 90%+ consistently voting, you know, for one party and one ideology. And, you know, second just behind that is white Americans who, you know, depending around, they're around, you know, the 70s and 80s, depending on when the campaign is. But the vision that keeps Black voters voting as a bloc is not like racial vengeance. It's like, additional social security benefits for caregivers for the years you're out of the workforce. It's like, you know, it's canceling student debt and universal health care and affordable housing and childcare and paid family leave. Like, those are the things that Black Americans want. And they're things that would be great for everyone, you know? Yeah. And so I think that we really need to recognize the ways in which systemic racism makes our entire society sort of meaner and poorer than it would be if we had more of a sense of social solidarity and a willingness invest in one another.
When I was in my early 20s, and let's just say not living my best life, my late brother-in-law and best friend, Peter, took me to France. Ostensibly, we were going to see and stay with his aunt, but really, I think he wanted to cheer me up. We went to the flea markets in the countryside on the weekends, where I found a set of very old religious medals. I decided to invest these medals with the belief that everything in my life could shift, and it did. I figured out how to frame them myself very badly, and they've stayed with me ever since. When Peter passed away in 2017, these medals became even more important to me, earning pride of place next to my desk. I look at them every day. But my poor framing job from 2002 started to fail recently, and so I decided to entrust them to Framebridge. I've been having Framebridge frame all of my family photos for years. You can upload digital prints, and they do a beautiful and speedy job, making them the perfect place for holiday gifts, as my mother-in-law and parents treasure photos of my kids. But Framebridge also takes on objects that are typically expensive and difficult to frame, whether it's menus, tickets, original artwork, personal milestones, license plates, hotel keys, keys to your first home, or in my case, medals. You can easily order online at framebridge.com or visit one of their 20-plus Framebridge retail stores. They provide free, secure, prepaid packaging for physical items, and you can ship them on over. They will then frame your piece and ship it to you in days. It's easy. It's affordable. You know exactly what it will cost up front, and they offer every conceivable framing option. Everything I've ever sent Framebridge has always looked even better than I expected. Plus, if you're not 100% happy with your piece, they'll make it right. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything. That's framebridge.com. So you talk about sort of this white Southerner in 1857, Hinton Rowan Helper, in this book that he published, The Impending Crisis of the South, How to Meet It. And you talk about how he was an avowed racist, mm-hmm. but he went and counted all these public institutions and the number, Pennsylvania, there were 393 public libraries versus South Carolina, where there were 26. Maine, 236 versus Georgia, 38. New Hampshire, 2,381 versus Mississippi, 782. And I thought it was so interesting, like the way that you tease out and explored, you know, slavery, which I think people in the North, Americans love to sort of be like, well, like you guys were on the wrong side. But right, slavery was what supported the entire U.S. economy. There were places in the North, as you remark, that were equally racist. And New York City wanted to succeed, right, when the Civil War happened?
Yes. New York merchants had gotten so rich from the slave economy, 40% of the city's exporting businesses through warehousing, shipping insurance, and sales were Southern cotton exports, that the mayor of New York advocated that his city secede along with the South.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild. And then the bigger point that Helper was making was about sort of white commoners and how deprived they were. If you don't mind if I read to you from your book, you write, Helper was an avowed racist, and yet he railed against slavery because he saw what it was doing to his fellow white Southerners. The slave economy was a system that created high concentrations of wealth, land, and political power. Quote, notwithstanding the fact that the white non-slaveholders of the South are in the majority as 5-1, they have never yet had any part or lot in framing the laws under which they live, unquote, Helper wrote. Yep. And without a voice in the policymaking, common white Southerners were unable to win much for themselves. And so essentially there was no investment in public goods, right? It was all power was sort of in these plantations. There was nothing else to support the society. And then you sort of throughout the book talk about how that's become sort of the prevailing narrative of America, right? Like limiting all of these public services and goods and all the power being in Jeff Bezos's pocket. No, but the way that we've continued, like that economic model has sort of permeated the whole country when it should have been the reverse.
This was really helpful to me, the Helper book, to have a contemporary, a white Southerner under slavery who became very anti-slavery and very useful to abolitionists in the North, because he was saying that it basically was only in the narrow economic interest of the, as he called them, the oligarchs of the lash to have this exploited system. Because, like, you know, your average white Southerner, if they weren't profiting off of slavery, they didn't have much economic prospects, right? Like the entire economy of the South was dependent on this captive labor force. The plantation didn't need very many white workers at all. And because the logic that creates the impulse to fund public goods, right? Like wealthy people will tax themselves in order to fund roads and bridges and infrastructure and schools, because it's in some aspect of their own self-interest, right? They need this infrastructure to get their goods to market. They need an educated workforce, right, to employ. They all of that, just that logic didn't exist, right? It's sort of this plantation mentality of this is a closed system. I will exploit the workers within this system, and I don't owe anything or need anything from anybody without. And, you know, I thought about that logic again recently when the Chamber of Commerce reacted to President Biden's proposal to have a slight increase in the corporate tax rate in order to pay for infrastructure. And the Chamber of Commerce was like, well, we don't think that the corporate sector should shoulder the burden of these infrastructure investments, like, you know, broad universal broadband and public transit and clean energy and, you know, grid improvements and, you know, road and other infrastructure, ports, bridges, you know, all this stuff. Or even the human infrastructure, right? As if like corporations do not benefit from universal childcare so that their workers can actually feel confident like going to work and all of this, right? And the logic was, you know, as the Chamber of Commerce said, we think that the, you know, the sort of users of the infrastructure should pay for it. Like there should be like private fees along all of the infrastructure. It's like, sort of like the toll road system. And it's that idea, right? That like we owe nothing to one another. They have benefited not at all from all of the investments that made their business possible. It's so ridiculous. And yet it is a very old logic.
And as you say, I mean, you throughout the book, you're sort of like, oh, and then they made sort of the beverage company give back $24 million in taxes that they had somehow avoided paying. Like there's so many moments in our sort of pro-business, anti-government society where we're being denied sort of the basic components of what makes a society safe so that theoretically, those benefits trickle down in some inconceivable way, which is clearly only in executive pay, shareholder returns, et cetera, all of these systems in which so many people don't participate. You know, it's maddening. Let's talk about, I mean, one of the things that I loved about the book is that it's also quite optimistic, and which doesn't sound that way, but it is. And there are so many moments, stories that you tease out of people moving past these racial divides, these sort of stoked fear and antipathy towards each other to unite, the solidarity dividend of uniting for sort of common good, yeah. Whether it's fighting for a $15 minimum wage or what's happening in Connecticut or how immigrants have revitalized Lewiston, all of these moments throughout our country that sort of fly in the face of what we've all been told will invariably happen if we have a more equitable society. Do you want to talk, like, where should we go? Should we talk about sort of Nissan unions? Do you want to talk about Lewiston? Do you want to talk about, like, what do you think
is? Yeah, I'm happy to talk. I tend to like to end on a high note. So, so The Sum of Us is a story of a journey of me going around the country and finding the fingerprints of racism in all of our core dysfunction, whether it's our unwillingness to address global climate change or the roots of the financial crisis or our singular refusal to give our citizens universal healthcare among advanced economies, we stand alone. All of these are issue areas, and there were so many communities across the country where I saw these issues really play out, where it felt like, you know, you can see why zero-sum thinking and drained pool politics is costing everyone. And yet I also was able to see evidence of the opposite, of people really coming together across lines of race and rejecting the zero sum and forming multiracial coalitions that were willing to fight for common solutions to our common problems. And I began to call this phenomenon a solidarity dividend. For me, solidarity dividends are gains that can be unlocked only when you come together across lines of race, things that you sort of can't accomplish when you're divided, that any individual can't win on their own, things like cleaner air and better wages and better funded schools. One of the more surprising places where I found evidence of the solidarity dividend was in the whitest state in the nation, in Maine, where a dying mill town, very much like, you know, deindustrialized towns all over the country, had really seen its best days behind it. And yet by sort of an accident of policy and fate, really, group of African Muslim refugees and immigrants began to take up residence and home and refuge in this dying mill town. And I talked to white Mainers who had seen not only their Main Street revitalized, their tax base grow, the school, which had been possibly going to close the same way that so many kind of depopulating mill towns had been closing their schools, expands and they build a new school and they win the state championship 5 times in soccer. And, you know, they, on an individual level, I talked to white Mainers who really experienced that kind of putting aside the distrust and the received wisdom, the stories from politicians, basically, who were, you know, kind of scapegoating and demonizing refugees and immigrants and saying, as they did often in the sort of Republican formula in Maine politics at the time, they would say, we have to cut welfare in Maine because illegal immigrants and refugees are stealing our money. And of course, the vast majority of people who are on welfare in Maine are white, like elderly Mainers, you know? And yet, you know, those kinds of politicians were voted back in again, you know, again and again, because there was this coherent story, this finger pointing. And yet in this town, I met these white Mainers who were willing to put that all aside and to link arms with these African Muslim refugees who in some ways had like the least in common with them of like any type of person in the world. And both of them, this woman Bruce, this woman Cecile, and this guy named Bruce, kind of, it saved their lives and it transformed their lives and it gave meaning to their lives and it helped improve their community to find that solidarity dividend and to fight together. And on my last trip to Maine, before I ended up, you know, kind of concluding the book, they had created this multiracial coalition anchored by these Somali taxi drivers who were able to drive around and pick up sort of homebound elderly white Mainers and bring them to the polls. This coalition was able to win a ballot initiative expanding Medicaid over the 5-time veto of their little mini Trump, this terrible guy named Paul LePage, who's a governor for far too long in Maine, because the people of Maine, mostly white people, really needed access to healthcare and were paid too little to be able to afford it on their own. And so I do believe that even since the book has been completed, there has been more evidence of this solidarity dividend all throughout the country, right? We had a multiracial coalition that in November and then again in January waded through high water to do the impossible and reject the Trumpist politics of divide and conquer, you know, vote for the idea that we could do big things together, like tackle this pandemic and you know, roll out a vaccine and help one another. The American Rescue Plan includes that was passed, you know, on a single party vote in the winter, you know, is now creating a nearly 50% decrease in child poverty that's estimated for this year because of checks that are going to families to help deal with the high cost of raising families. And it's not everything, but it'll make a huge difference in the lives of working families of all backgrounds. And to me, that's a solidarity dividend. It would not have been possible without a multiracial coalition. And it is refilling the pool of public goods to say, you know what? It costs a lot. We're not going to make families try to do this on their own when we know the math doesn't add up. We're not going to ignore the evidence of our country having the worst in the world child poverty rates for a country with our advanced economy. We're not going to just ignore that and pretend like it's the kids' fault. We're going to just give people money and trust parents to be able to figure it out, to make the math add up themselves. That to me is like a new day in our politics, and ultimately quite hopeful and optimistic, because that's just one aspect of where I think the sort of emerging multiracial majority in this country is headed. That's where the policies are, and frankly, supported by a bipartisan majority of the country.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
In rural communities, hospitals, medical centers are 1 out of 7 people are employed there, right? So there are all these institutions and goods that were also, you know, people are ironically dependent on for their healthcare that then disappear from these local communities, leaving people in a real bind, primarily white people, white poor people. So I love how hopeful the book is. It's also such an incredible education, particularly in the chapter about the financial collapse in 2008 and what was happening with subprime mortgages and how predatory those were, and how this, you know, I'd heard this, the myth of like, oh, it's just people who were completely, you know, buying their third house and, or, you know, couldn't afford a house at all. Whereas, as you explain, it was majority people of color being sought out for refinancing loans and being completely screwed, which again, it goes to that whole, that racial stereotype, that trope that's such a current of financial irresponsibility and people bringing this on themselves, which is sort of counter to the reality of the actual facts. So I thought that was such a huge public service, that chapter alone, incredible. And the other thing, this was staggering to me, but I feel like it's such an important piece of education. When you talk about sort of how we all share the same sky, and of course, you know, marginalized neighborhoods are typically laddered with like all the toxic waste dumps, all the landfills, et cetera. Everything ends up in poor communities, but that it travels, the pollution travels, obviously, and that this is stunning. The Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, fewer than 25% of white people said they were willing to join a campaign to convince government to act on climate change, whereas 70% of the Latinx population, 57% of Black people are either alarmed or concerned. Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about this, but like there's also sort of the, I don't know how to describe it, the racism of like so many of these social initiatives are led by white people, right? Who, and I don't want to call out like the people who are working on environmental justice, because thank you to all of them for their work. But we're like missing this huge part of the story, which is like white people are not on board. Like, what is happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that I when I set out and kind of outlined what I wanted to write about and research in the book, I hadn't actually intended to include a chapter on climate change and the environment, but it felt like once I began to see this phenomenon and this pattern, I was like, well, I mean, if you think about like, what are some of the nice things that we can't seem to have in this country? It's like clean air and water and like a rational, aggressive response to the existential threat that is climate change. Like, why are we not doing this? You know, like America's supposed to be Superman. Why are we not seeing a meteor coming towards the planet and like running into the phone booth and getting changed and like,
yeah. Meanwhile, we're on fire, literally. It's wild.
And so I was like, okay, well, let's see. Like, let's see where the evidence takes us. And as you said, it turns out that there's actually a significant gap in concern and alarm about environmental degradation and climate change that is racial. And I wanted to dig in, like, why is that? That doesn't necessarily make the same kind of common sense that some of the other sort of racialized views of politics did to me. And I ended up having to go to a whole body of research by these people in Scandinavian countries who've really looked at the correlation between kind of the worldview, like the deeper worldview that comes with being kind of at the top of a social and racial and economic hierarchy, which is like risk averse, like downplaying risk. Common sense, like you don't experience it as much. And so you're not as sensitive to it. The idea that sort of if people are struggling, if misfortune happens, it's probably because of something they did. And so there's a sense that like, well, you know, climate change is probably going to be bad for poor people, for poor countries, but that's just sort of like the way the world works, right? Like that's just, you know, if they worked harder or were better, you know, they would be safer. And of course, you know, that is like the most costly fallacy in the world, right? You know, climate change is coming for us all. There are, of course, massive disparities in how immediately people will be hurt and how easy it will be for people to recover. But like, it is just an extremely costly illusion to think that we don't have to act in the collective interest of our planet, because, you know, we're generally the winners in society.
Yeah, no, there's no, clearly no escape, as we've come to understand. Before I let you go, curious if there are a few, this is not rapid fire, but like three, four, however many that you wish everyone would read or that you've loved lately, could be podcasts.
I have a lot of great books these days. There's a podcast called Floodlines that's like, you know, I'm not the only person to recognize that it's just an extraordinary feat. It's an Atlantic podcast about New Orleans and Katrina. And it's sort of like the like seminal investigative, very human focused story of what went wrong and how that was so much of a man-made disaster and continues to be. There's a book called 400 Souls, which I have one tiny chapter in, but is a really cool, particularly now at this time when history is under attack from a very organized right-wing sort of donor class. It's a compendium of short pieces of history from 1619 to the present. And it's just amazing. Like, it's just like, there's just so much history that you would never have had the occasion to know in the way that we've all been educated. And it's fascinating. And it's great because it's like, you can just like have it, you know, at your bedside and like read, you know, a couple at a time and just learn about parts of what they call a community history of African America. And then I'm in the middle of the N.K. Jemisin book, The City We Became. And I really like speculative fiction and summers when I kind of indulge and more fiction, so I'm really enjoying that as well.
Wow. Well, thank you for joining our conversation today. I feel like we just scratched the surface of The Sum of Us, which is such an education. I like many of you, am doing my best to sort of get educated. Embarrassingly, I feel like I'm not alone in feeling like I never really understood or got a full or accurate view of the history of this country. And it has been quite a reckoning, as I know it has been for the rest of you, and also a reckoning in how we address this and move forward. And one of the most important, impactful things we can do, obviously, is one, to vote, two, to participate in our local communities and our local governments, because that's where so many of these decisions are passed down. There are so many incredible moments in the book, for example, where Heather talks about how states, more conservative states, despite what the people of that state might want across racial lines, would refuse government assistance like expanded Medicaid. Rick Perry was like, I essentially don't want this money from the federal government, which would ensure tens of thousands of Texans, many white people as well, who make more than $4,000. The other thing that we didn't get to, which is so important when particularly in the context of voting, is the ways in which people have been sort of, including white people, again, she gives some sort of stories of people who went to vote, and because they had, can't remember which state has these laws now, where they'd been taken off the voting rolls because they had missed two elections in a row. And this particular man, this white man, was like, I don't understand. So you're saying that just because I haven't used my right to protest means that I no longer have access to free speech, that just because I haven't bought a gun would mean that I don't have access to the Second Amendment anymore. Like, voting is a constitutional right that's now being denied to many people because they don't want people to vote. But there's collateral damage in every sort of part of society. And Heather writes too about how women are finding themselves struggling to vote because some states require that there are exact name matches across forms of identification. So they're going to vote and maybe their maiden name hasn't been changed across the board. Mine certainly hasn't. And they can't vote. And that's terrifying, because we're responsible for our government and yet being denied from participating in it, which means it's not a democracy. And then I think that there's also, which we touched on a little bit, but I think that this continues for so many of us, particularly in this time, this pandemic, George Floyd, this incredible reckoning on every single level around our values. Whether that's how do we spend our time? What are we buying? How are we choosing to engage with our families? All of these questions, sort of what it means to be alive right now. And part of that is contending with the past and with sort of this incredible, the oppression of feeling like you're an oppressor and not knowing how to fix that or change that, which is, I think, really devastating in a way that's hard to reckon with. But it's certainly something that I think holds true for so many people, that for myself, or so many people who have stopped. It's just a huge moral cost of racism, to quote Heather McGee. And finish this ramble with another part of the book where she quotes, of course, that incredible observer of life, James Baldwin. He's writing about sort of white people and racism, but this holds for so many things. This holds for climate change. This holds for so many systems or moments in our collective history where we feel powerless in the face of things that we wish we could change, where we feel sort of responsible. So much, I think, what also happens is these government policies are put on us somehow, as though we might not have wanted them. So he writes, what they see as a disastrous, continuing present condition which menaces them and for which they bear an inescapable responsibility. But since, in the main, they seem to lack the energy to change this condition, they would rather not be reminded of it. Baldwin went on to observe that white Americans are dimly or vividly aware that the history they have fed themselves is mainly a lie, but they do not know how to release themselves from it, and they suffer enormously from the resulting personal incoherence. That feels like my experience, but I feel better off for having read Heather's book. Again, it's also full of really, really hopeful and wonderful stories of people rallying around our common humanity and letting go of the ways in which we've been divided to create really good, to essentially unionize. You know, I don't know as much about the unions as I wish that I did. And she does a fair amount of exploration around unions and sort of the gains that they've met. But that's how, you know, so many of us have benefited. That's how we got paid time off collectively, regardless of industry. That's how we got healthcare, which theoretically should not be tied to employment status, but it was a win. It's how we got paid overtime. All so many wins via the union that permeated the whole economy. This is a quote from Heather's book. She writes, "Economists have calculated that if unions were as common today as they were in 1979, weekly wages for men not in a union would be 5% higher, for non-college educated men, 8% higher. If that bump sounds small, compare that to the fact that since 1979, wages for the typical hourly worker have increased only 0.3% a year. Meanwhile, pay for the richest 1% has risen by 190%. Anyway, staggering. So much to think about. Thank you for listening. If you liked today's episode, please rate, review, share it with your friends, and please read The Sum of Us. You can find me on Instagram. I'm always happy to talk about books. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at theelisepodcast.com. Please sign up for my newsletter. I promise I won't spam you. Or follow me on Instagram at Elise Lunan to get updates on new episodes. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread, available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts, i.e. wherever you're listening right now. I also want to thank you in advance for sharing any episodes with friends who you think might like the show, because that is how podcasts grow. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Serena Reagan, Mary-Kate McDonough, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duval for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.